This is the Late Round Podcast with your host, JJ Zacharisa. JJ Zacharisa.
What's up, everyone? It's JJ Zacharyson, the editor-in-chief at FanDuel and at NumberFire.com, and this is episode 225 of the Late Round Podcast, one of the many shows that are part of the NumberFire Podcast Network. Thanks for tuning in. Before we get into this week's mailbag questions, I want to let you all know that FanDuel is celebrating the start of the NBA playoffs with the Fantasy Playoff by throwing a huge yacht party in Miami, presented by Playboy. Keep up with all the NBA action, party with the playmates and celebrity guests, and watch a special performance by Flo Rida. Qualify now to earn your spot for the chance to join the celebration and compete for a share of $1 million in prizes by visiting FanDuel.com/fantasy. That's FanDuel.com/FANTASEA. This first question is from Twitter. It's from @DynastyDynamite. How much film do you watch? At what point in the process do you watch it? How much value do you place on it for the purposes of fantasy? I'm actually surprised that no one's ever asked this question before. It seems like one that would get asked pretty frequently, but it's not. I watch every single game. I think it would be hard to do my job effectively if I had no idea what these players looked like. But I would never sell myself as a, quote, film guy. As for how much value I place on it, I'm not sure how to really answer that question. I don't think that you can play fantasy football well if you're relying solely on film, though. Fantasy is a game about numbers. It's not a game strictly about talent. Watching what's unfolding on a football field can help you in some way, but someone who's ignoring data is not going to be a winning fantasy player. I definitely rely more on data than film because I know that I'm better at it. And the thing is, a lot of time, most times, the two overlap. Someone who's dominating from a data perspective is probably going to look good on film too. So I actually think that there's often too much of a divide when people are talking about this topic. But I think emphasizing the fact that fantasy football is a numbers-driven game, that's important here. And just because I'm a data-driven analyst doesn't mean that I'm not watching the game. I watch a lot of football because it helps me be a more well-rounded analyst. This next question is from @22jbright. Dynasty draft pick worth. What's a good ask for an early first-round rookie draft pick, i.e., what is the 103 worth in dynasty leagues? So I actually did a study and a podcast on this topic last year. If you want to listen to that show, it's episode 113 and it's titled The Value of Rookie Picks. My findings are that fantasy managers do tend to overrate those picks' value. We're not very good at projecting which players will be successful at the next level. For a lot of reasons. Scouting and prospecting is very hard. But I think it's important to remember that draft picks are currency. Just because they're overrated doesn't mean that you should just give them up for nothing. And on top of that, you still need to be building youth on your team. You still need rookies on your team. And if you only have your startup draft and then just trade for players all the time, you're not necessarily allowing yourself to extract insane value. You're going to miss out on a lot of the elite players in fantasy. You wouldn't be able to get Saquon Barkley or Ezekiel Elliott or Christian McCaffrey. And how you value these picks is pretty dependent by year. Like, there's no obvious 101 pick this season. Even if some of these players go to a great landing spot, it probably still won't make them the consensus top pick. That means the 101 this season is far less valuable than what it was last year. Because last year was quite obviously Saquon Barkley. I also tend to buy my draft picks before the NFL draft happens and not after. Given the information that we have right now, we don't have a consensus 101. And you could get away with rearranging the first round in a lot of different ways. At running back specifically, rankings and player values are all over the place right now. But like I've been saying the last few weeks, this running back draft class is going to be super landing spot dependent. So when we know those landing spots, we're going to be able to place where these running backs should be drafted more accurately. Like, maybe you've got Miles Sanders as your RB6 right now. Some people really like Sanders and have him close to the top of the running back class, but others don't. There's no set ADP for Miles Sanders. Now, imagine if Sanders gets drafted by the Chiefs. All of a sudden, you've got a new early first rounder that's more set in stone, and that's going to raise the price for that type of pick. And it's all because people know who they'll be getting at that slot. But I'd listen to that episode for a more in-depth study on how to value these picks. And keep in mind, it's not just about how you value them, but how your league mates value them. This next question is from @BayAreaViper. How likely is it that Antonio Brown and Todd Gurley will be top 10 fantasy assets at their position for the next 2 to 3 years? I think I'm more convinced that Gurley will be rather than Antonio Brown. I've talked about this on the show before, but I have a hard time imagining Antonio Brown's fantasy value getting better in a different location. It's probably going to get worse. Over the last 3 years, the Steelers have ranked 9th, 6th, and 1st in pass attempts. During this time, AB has had a top 10 target share in the league each season, and that's without playing full seasons. So what that means is that AB is consistently seeing a large chunk of a large pie. He's getting a ton of volume. As of this recording, a trade hasn't gone down. But almost no matter where he goes, he's likely to see a quarterback downgrade. Or at the very least, one where there's not a lot of experience playing with him. And then that team is also likely to not be as pass-heavy as the Steelers have been. So the combination of the two makes Mr. Big Chest, less attractive from a fantasy perspective. And that's without even referencing that he'll be 31 years old in July. Things aren't sounding great with Todd Gurley's knee, but I still think that he's more likely to be a more consistent top 10 finisher over the next couple of seasons because of his situation. If some of the stories I'm reading about his knee are correct, I would doubt we see a Todd Gurley season like we've seen over the last two ever again. His usage is going to not be as high. But the competition at running back isn't super intense. It's absolutely possible that he finishes outside the top 10 over the next two seasons. And it's possible his knee has everything to do with it. But if I'm comparing him to Antonio Brown, who's almost certainly going to see a downgrade in situation, and who's also going to be 31 next season, I'll take the chance with the knee and say that Todd Gurley will be a better fantasy asset. But I would be lying if I said I wasn't worried about either of them. I'm very nervous about Brown's next destination, wherever that may be. And there's definitely some concern over Gurley's knee. They're not guys that I would be buying right now. This next question is from @veganfauxplez. Is it possible that the 102 is more valuable this year since there is not a consensus 101? In theory, a person could have their idea of the 101 fall to them at like 105. How can this be leveraged in trade talks? I would think that a lot of dynasty managers understand the same thing that you're talking about here, that it's a pretty flat draft class. But to reiterate what I said earlier, we should have more clarity once the NFL draft is over. We'll have a better idea as to where to rank these players. That's what makes the picks easier to acquire now than later. When things are chaotic, and if people currently view the 105 as not much different than the 102, then that means that you should try to acquire the 102 right now. Because at some point in your rookie draft, if you're drafting after the NFL draft happens, there will be some sort of drop-off in consensus rankings. Maybe that's after the 101, maybe that's after the 103, but it will exist. It's like last season how it was after like the 108 when Kerryon Johnson would get drafted. So keep that in mind. When you're reading the market, you have to also read information that you currently have available and how that will influence the market. This next question is from @MikeY24953167. I have no idea how you remember that number. A couple of weeks ago, you posted that moving OBJ is a bad call. Are there statistics that show that having a true wide receiver one helps a team be successful? It seems like all of the expensive/elite wide receivers also play for bad/mediocre teams. This is definitely a narrative that's out there and that a lot of people believe in. And I can understand it when you look strictly at Super Bowl winners. A lot of Super Bowl winning teams don't have elite wide receivers. One thing that we always have to remember with cost-related questions like this one is that we're not going to see perfect correlation between player talent and salary at all positions. And it's not just because teams make bad calls in signing these players. Each year, players get better and better deals at each position. So the most recent free agent class is the hypothetical richest. But even if you go down the list of the most expensive wide receivers last season, there's not that weak of a correlation between those players and their team's overall record. Like, I don't think that we can just conclude that. Odell Beckham is the most expensive and the Giants weren't great, sure. But Antonio Brown ranked second and the Steelers were easily the best team to miss the playoffs. DeAndre Hopkins was fourth. Brandon Cooks was fifth and his team won the NFC. Sammy Watkins was sixth, and his team was an offsides call away from being in the Super Bowl. I don't necessarily have anything that's absolute proof that you need elite wide receivers, and you should give elite wide receivers big contracts. I can tell you that of the wideouts with 50 or more targets last season, 9 of the top 20 wide receivers in target success rate were also in the top 20 in salary. There's no context for that, though. And that's the thing. We can't just look at the correlation of elite receivers to team success without doing the same for every other position. That's the only way to really know if there's something there. And even if you find something moderately there, there are so many other factors that go into that type of analysis. I also can't stand when people make team building judgments based on Super Bowl winners, which I'm not accusing you of doing here. It's just something that happens. But looking at who wins a Super Bowl and making team building decisions based on that is a terrible idea. Not only is the NFL playoff a single elimination one that has lots of variance, but the sample size is going to be small. We only have a handful of Super Bowl winners in this current pass-first era. But the reason I think elite wide receivers are really important to today's game is because I know that factually, passing is really important to today's game. That's something we can actually analyze. That passing matters and wide receivers are part of that passing equation. Running doesn't matter all that much. It's a lot more difficult to gain an edge through running the football than it is through passing it. So if I'm GMing a team, I'm going to do whatever I can do to enhance the pass and stop the pass. And a player like Odell Beckham is an elite player at a position that is part of the passing game. So I don't have a direct answer for you with this question, but the overall reasoning is because you should always try to do things that help improve the pass. Maybe the opportunity cost in having that contract is too high. I haven't done that analysis, and that's a core piece to your question. But you'd then have to prove your alternatives are making a bigger impact to show that having a player like OBJ on a big contract is a mistake. This next question is from @Freezy2.0. Is Kyler the 101 for Superflex rookie drafts? As of today, I think he is, and I doubt that that changes. I do think a team who doesn't need a quarterback at all can probably bypass Kyler Murray and get someone like N'Keal Harry. But I'm also a believer that quarterbacks can also be currency in Superflex Dynasty. Others will value them far more than I will, but I just want numbers. I just want as many starters in the league that I can in order to have leverage. But because there's no obvious 101 this season, and because I don't think that we'll get absolute clarity there after the draft, I think Murray is fine as the 101 in the Superflex rookie draft. This next question is from @Steven0128. In the past, you've said in Dynasty rookie drafts, draft running backs and trade for established wide receivers. Given that the rookie class is relatively strong at wide receiver and weak at running back, will you be adjusting your strategy this year? On the last podcast at the end, you made it seem like you would. So I think I need to do a better job communicating this point, and that's on me. When I said that I use rookie drafts to get my running backs, I don't want people to think that I never draft rookie wide receivers in rookie drafts. I'm still getting both positions. You have to get both positions. The reason I usually go more running back focused in rookie drafts is because you can get immediate production from that position. So if my startup draft was wide receiver heavy, which it almost always is, then I'm probably good at wide receiver for some time. So I'll focus on running backs. I'm not necessarily trading for established receivers. It's just that my team will be good at wide receiver given how I drafted it. But I'll take running backs in the first round all the time. I got a lot of Kerryon Johnson last year. And I also got some DJ Moore. It's all dependent on what works best for your roster. And as I've been saying, I think we're going to get a lot more clarity at running back after the draft is over. This is definitely a landing spot dependent draft for these guys. I can't stress that enough. But when we know those landing spots, we'll feel more comfortable getting some of those players in the first round. This last question is from @Cincy_Valentine. What are the least helpful stats in evaluating rookie talent? I'm assuming there are at least a few red herring stats people put too much stock into. I think people often focus a little too much on efficiency at running back specifically. It matters to a degree, but volume is still far more predictive. And the basic reasoning is because good players see the ball more often. It can't hurt to be efficient, but it's not everything. That's why Daryl Henderson, even though I might have him as my RB1 when this is all said and done, that's why he still doesn't have a complete production profile. The volume isn't totally there. And that's even though he averaged 8.9 yards per carry over his final two seasons at Memphis. And then I also think people who aren't doing a lot of production-related scouting are just putting too much weight into raw statistics. You've got to give these numbers context. You have to look at market share. You can't compare a wide receiver from Army to one from Washington State. That's where I think people goof when they're looking at statistics for these guys. And I think I'm officially a dad because I just used the word goof. That's going to do it for today's show, though. Thanks to all of you guys for listening. If you've yet to subscribe to the Late Round Podcast, make sure you are by searching for it on iTunes, Google Play, SoundCloud, TuneIn, Stitcher, and Spotify. And if you're on iTunes, please do me a solid and leave a rating and review. I'm also on Twitter @LateRoundQB. If you have a question for a future mailbag show, you can send it to there, or you can email me at jj@numberfire.com. Thanks, everyone. Enjoy your weekend.